The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at newbalance.com. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Pick Six Podcast, CBS Sports Daily NFL Podcast. I'm Will Brinson. I'm your host. It is now Thursday, August 20th. Excited to keep Analytics Week rolling along, or as we're affectionately calling it, Nerd Week. Joining us now, good friend of the program, the second tallest media member in the NFL circles behind only Pete Prisco.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say.
Steve Palazzolo. What's going on, Steve?
I didn't know you were calling it Nerd Week. You said it was Analytics Week.
See, we don't tell you to get on the show that it's Nerd Week.
That's fine. I've been called worse. That works though. Thank you.
What is senior? I feel like you're like in. I mean, you and Sam to me, and obviously there's a lot of people involved with PFF, but like you and Sam feel like the faces of PFF to me. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think we have been to this point, and you know, senior analyst has been like an all-encompassing role, but I've pretty much, Sam and I have both kind of worn every hat here. Hi, buddy.
Steve, father of four, and if you want to see what his fantastic kids look like,
I'm recording right now. That's your birthday present, so just go stare at the box.
And look, like, you got to understand, Steve, this is a kid-friendly podcast, not in the sense that the content is appropriate for children, but as I was telling you before.
They're in and out.
I mean, my son pops up here Debo, how many times does Robbie pop into this podcast? Like once a week?
Once a week for Oreos, once a week for iPad.
Yeah. So like if his mom is out doing, AK's out doing something, he's coming up here. And I'm like, don't come up here.
Dude. He sense up the red light. Like they sense when it's record time.
I'm dead serious. He learned. So for a while, my wife was working, downtown Raleigh at this museum and I was taking care of Robbie full time and doing my full time job. And he figured out at that point that if I did a radio hit, he could yell Oreos as loudly as possible. And I had no choice but to turn the Oreos over to him.
Wow.
And at 9 a.m., noon, 3 p.m., 7 p.m., didn't matter. If I was doing radio, he's yelling Oreos. And now he has a crippling Oreo addiction, unfortunately.
Whatever you got to do, man. I mean, I think it's become endearing, you know, to have. The kids in and out, you know.
It used
they're
to
on NFL Network all the time and all that stuff, right?
I mean, it used to be unprofessional, and now it's like in pandemic, it's like what a great player.
Yeah, right. You
know, what a stand up guy.
Well, I took their playroom used to be my office, and I took it back and made it my office. So it's kind of like it's a shared space.
Yeah, I mean, like people can see it again. You can go to youtube.com/pick6 and watch this whole episode, and you have all the go tos. Like you have the little. I don't even know what they're called. I don't know who makes them, but the chairs with the name stitched on the back. Like you have a Harry back there. And we have the exact same one with like some white outline that says Robbie. And you can tell that your kids like him because they're all bent. Like Robbie piles in his and plays Nintendo and you have the little standalone trampoline thing. I mean, it's a quintessential playroom.
I've had 6 months to fix my quarantine background and I still have the same one. So,
I've had this for like 3 years and people are like, oh, that's a pretty good quarantine background. I was like, no, that's just like my professional one. They're like, oh, well, that's not.
I love it. We're all on the same boat here.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's talk some football. So sort of a general broad state of analytics in the NFL. You guys at PFF, and I'm not certainly going to ask you to like name the teams you work with because you wouldn't tell me, but
all 32. It's all 32.
So are you up to all 32 now?
Yeah. We've had them for a couple of years now. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you probably told me this in like passing at an NFL event, but so what is the varying level? Is there like a sliding scale of how involved teams are in NFL analytics? Cause it does feel like at a certain point within the last 5 years, I'm guessing every owner or every, you know, went to their GM and said like, hey, look, you know, everybody's in on this PFF thing. So and I'm guessing that not everybody is as involved as, you know, it's not an equal involvement, right?
It's true, right? So, it's been actually one of the more fascinating things that I've seen through the years is so like at the combine, when we all see each other, that's when we meet with every team. And we have a whole team of guys that are out on the road meeting with these teams all the time. But that's like my opportunity to sit in like 32 meetings and kind of see. There are some teams that roll in with like 15 people and they want to know every last thing that we have and what we're doing and what's the next piece of data that you guys have and how is it being delivered and how can we use it, all that stuff. And then there's another team that might have one guy and he's like, look, I'm trying to make headway with the coaches and they won't even listen to me. So it is, I think, one of the biggest stories is that some teams have four meetings with us at the combine. They're like, I'm going to get the special teams coaches in here. Then we'll have a defensive coaches. Then we'll have the scouts. So it is fascinating to me that every team has different levels of competency and usage and style and all this stuff. It's really 32 differently run organizations. So like when you hear analytics as this broad, broad term, right, it's just used so many different ways across the league.
Do you, I guess this is fine to ask, do you anecdotally, do you see a connection between success on the field and more in-depth analytic usage, or does it not really matter?
So I think football is such a unique sport because the quarterback is just so important.
Sure.
So it's almost like you can have a bad analytically driven team, but if they have a good quarterback, it's like, all right, you know, they have a good quarterback. It makes up for a whole bunch of other ills. So I think it's hard to, you know, correlate it directly, but I think it's clear a team like the Ravens last year, I mean, it's not even a PFF thing. It's just they do everything. It's not just PFF that's done studies. It's like, the Ravens found an edge in every place where you should have an edge.
Okay, right? So like, let me ask you this about the Ravens specifically, because even Mitchell Schwartz sort of mocked me for this suggestion. And like I said that if you look at all the running backs that the Ravens acquired, they are all very good at running out of shotgun. And that, like, I mean, like J.K. Dobbins was one of the most efficient shotgun runners in college football last year. Mark Ingram, if you break it down, was one of the most efficient shotgun runners with the Saints. Gus Edwards was a very efficient shotgun runner. Justice Hill was one of the most efficient shotgun runners coming out of Oklahoma State. Is that coincidence? Or that's analytics, right? Am I crazy? That's analytics. If you utilize, maybe not.
I don't know if that's the reasoning there. The whole thing with the run game and, like, you know, we're in football Twitter.
Mr. Schwartz is right.
Maybe a little bit. There's the corner of analytics Twitter that says running backs don't matter. If I could interpret that, because that's not, like, I hate using that phrase. I hate because it just doesn't convey the message. It's essentially like, okay, running backs like the fifth most important thing when it comes to the rushing attack. I don't have the hard numbers in front of me, but I think the difference between under center and shotgun is probably down the list as well.
Okay.
I think the reason why the Ravens have had so much success, in part because of Lamar Jackson, but it's the run blocking, it's box count, it's the quality of the defense, and it's the fact that Lamar changes the box count, changes the numbers, and the defensive linemen, you saw this in college a lot early in the zone read era. Defensive linemen, they don't even try to shed blocks anymore. They're looking for the ball. Like, where's the ball? Where's the ball? And you're getting blown off the ball by a double team, you know, because they're running power at you or whatever it is. I think all of that added up has led to Raven success.
I wasn't saying necessarily that's why they're successful running out of the shotgun, just that I think they use that analysis of those players' skill sets to acquire them where they did because they know that they can more easily fit into the scheme. And Mitchell's point was like, well, he said, these guys do well what we want to do. He's like, that's not analytics. I was like, well, that is analytics. Like, if you identify someone who does something well that you already do, and then you fit them into your system, isn't that, maybe I'm getting too deep into the semantics here.
No, it is, but it's just like, hey, I know my kicker can't kick, beyond 53 yards.
My kicker sucks in the wind, so I'm not, you're like, yes.
Or just saying, like, you can't kick beyond 53, so if it's a 54, I'm going to say no, like, I'm going to go for it or punt or whatever. I mean, that's like, here's a number, and we know there's numbers on either side of it that make sense and don't make sense. So, yeah, I mean, there's a point. I just don't know how much the Ravens have actually used that specific example, right, unless you have some inside info.
No, I don't.
You keep pushing that, I know.
I do keep pushing that. I just stumbled into it. It's like, I like to push the only little nuggets I have. I guess my point of that is that I think you're right. I think the Ravens' entire organization is heavily steeped in analytics and using whatever information they have and all kinds of information they can get in order to gain an edge.
Those are your new vitamins.
Points. Oh, vitamins. Flintstones?
They're gummy bites. You got to go downstairs, though.
Can I have one?
Tomorrow, later, we'll open them. New vitamins in town. Can you shut the door on the way down? Thanks.
You're showing a tremendous amount of patience, by the way. Like, I'd be like,
doing my best.
Out of here. What areas of growth have you seen from teams in terms of usage of analytics over the last year, and what are you sort of expecting in the future? I know that's extremely broad, but I don't know if there's some good examples you might have.
Yeah, again, I think everybody, because, you know, we live in the social media world. I think everybody, when they use analytics, they have something in mind, you know, and a lot of times it's like, well, fourth down decisions, that's analytics. And of course, it's all a piece of a bigger puzzle. I think the fourth down decisions, you're seeing more of that. There's way more teams plugged in to that decision-making process and fewer teams going off a field.
Remember when Bill Belichick went for it on fourth and two, Pete Prisco calls it
09.
Yeah, 09. He goes, fourth and jackass. Remember when I made that great thing? It's like, Pete, that wasn't funny then. It's not funny now. Stop saying it. But like when he did that, it was a huge thing and people freaked out for weeks about it. Now it would be like, oh, you know, he went for it, didn't get it. What are you going to do? I mean, it's become very commonplace.
Before, I'm not like the numbers nerd at PFF.
Right.
But, you know, there's people that are smarter than me from a number standpoint. And then I think, even just like that play back in 2009, it intuitively just made sense to me. It was like, okay, it's fourth and two. You literally have one play 2 yards away from winning the game. The game's over if you hit this one play versus you don't get it, and then a whole bunch of other stuff has to happen. Granted, it's Peyton Manning and whatever, but like a whole bunch of other stuff has to happen for you to lose. It just made a lot of sense to me. And I think the change is like coaches always thinking about the worst case scenario, right? It's like, if I don't get it, or if I don't make this fourth and three, then what happens? Instead of saying, when I make this fourth and three, here's how it changes things, right? And your Pete is always like, gotta kick it. I mean, he cannot type it in fast enough. Always take the points, right, Pete? But like that mentality, and I'm not saying Pete's always wrong. He's probably wrong like 80% of the time when he says that.
But
that mentality is, take the points because you know you're going to get the three, but you're not even thinking about, okay, if you don't get it and you come away with 0 points, the other team has to drive 93 yards or whatever it might be. And the chances are that you're going to stop them somewhere along the line and you're going to be back in field goal range pretty quickly. Like, so it's taking this like a long-term approach to the game rather than this like right in the moment, take that 3 points because it feels good. And it's taking like a longer approach and letting the numbers kind of dictate things.
And for years, and it's still true even now because people like Pete are going to do it. If a coach takes 3 points and gets the field goal, no one's going to blame him.
Oh, of course.
If you go for it and miss it, you're going to get yelled at. And there's going to be some decent praise for being a little aggressive and ballsy if you go for it and get the touch. You know, so it's like, coaches are just inherently conservative and they don't want to get fired, and people get fired very quickly and without, you know, I mean, you know, there's not much time in the NFL. So going for it is obviously just, it's not a greater risk, but like the downside is that, you know, a bunch of media members are going to write stories that call you an idiot for not taking the points.
Yeah, I think I had a joke tweet a couple of years ago where I was like, you know, some coach is going to get up there sometime and just like, speak analytically, but like in common sense, like, of course I went for it on fourth down. My win probability went up. And of course I, you know, passed the ball 26 times to start the game because it's more efficient for winning. Like, somebody's going to get up there and do that at some point. And those are like easy answers, right? It's not going by the book, I don't think is safer, because if you're using win probability, then it's actually not safer, right? Like Pete Carroll had that last year. Like, oh, we're going to take the safe field goal. It's like, how is it safe kicking a 50-yard field goal instead of trusting Russell Wilson to pass for 1 yard, right? Like, how is that even safer? Because all the numbers say it's not, you know? So I think that stuff will switch a little bit. It's just, it's a change in mentality. And it's fascinating to me when I talk to coaches about like what goes through their head in their, that pushes them to suboptimal decisions. Like, I have to call a run every now and again because my linemen like to hit people. It's like, you don't have to have linemen hit people. You could just teach them at the beginning of camp, we're here to win games. And if we don't call a run play, like, we're not going to call a run play. Sorry. You know,
would you never run?
No. It's not never
run. Like, you shouldn't run just to run.
No, and coaches actually do that. I thought Joe Thomas did a great job of explaining that on Twitter one time. He was like, a lot of coaches call plays from columns, and it's like, here's this pass column, here's this run column, and it's like, pass, pass, pass. Uh-oh, I haven't called a run in a while. Let's call a run. And he said Kyle Shanahan is more like a story, and it's like, I'm going to call this run that's going to set up this pass, that's going to set up this end around, that's going to send up this end around play action, and it all, like, meshes. Like, that makes sense to me from a play call standpoint. And I've actually talked to coaches who, again, say, like, I haven't called a run in a while. Got to call a run. I think numbers wise, it would tell you spread to run, run when the box count tells you to, and run more in third and one, third and two, third and three, and fourth and one, fourth and two, right? So the times when it almost feels like it's third down, I have to pass because if I get, you know, it just, you would actually run more often. And if you're going to run, don't necessarily bring 17 tight ends in there like Stanford does, right. You know, spread it out.
That's exactly what Aaron Schott said on Monday's show was that. Yeah. I agree. Like, the move is to make it look like you're going to pass and then run.
Yeah, right.
Or make it look like you're going to run and then pass. And those things are more efficient because they're not easily diagnosed. And there is sort of like a coin flip roulette fallacy too, to the idea that it's like, well, I've passed seven times in a row. I have to run. Like, if anything, passing again is going to seem less likely to your other, like the other coach. True. Like, if you keep passing, they're going to be like, well, surely he's got to run at some point.
I would say, and here's one of the best explanations, I think, from, you know, Zach Robinson, who used to work for us, you know, played NFL quarterback. He was a backup everywhere, but, you know, he was like, sometimes the quarterback needs just a mental break. And especially if you're not Tom Brady, you're probably, I understand the point of like, I don't want to take any quarterback and put 50 decisions on his plate in a game and go and say, we're going to throw 50 times with you, Josh Allen or Mitch Trubisky, or whichever guy we're trashing lately. Like with Brady, it's okay. You could do that. You put everything on his plate. You trust him to make 50 good decisions or at least 49 out of 50 in a given game. So that part, like, I get that too. But at the same time, when you have an average quarterback or a lesser quarterback, you actually want to pass on early downs in times that are more favorable. You can't just go run third and nine, go get him, subpar quarterback.
He's gonna be getting teed off on third and nine, whereas at first and 10, he's probably seeing some run defense. And
right.
And by the way, it's not like Tom Brady threw the ball 50 times a game for the first 5 years of his career. I mean, like, he had to get to a point where he was, you know, mastered the offense and before he was really doing that. You mentioned Josh Allen. So let's talk about Josh Allen. Analytically speaking, nobody, like, I mean, it was pretty clear, like, who liked Josh Allen and who didn't. And I don't want to invoke Pete Prisco 42 times on this podcast, but like, Pete is one of the biggest Josh Allen, like, table bangers on the planet. He's like, he's an alpha male. That's
sounds right.
A thing. Like, okay. He's a dog. He's a leader. It's like, well, that is a thing. That's great. I don't know that is going to make him successful, guaranteed, in the NFL. And then from, you know, I think a lot of people, and we do like to make fun of Josh Allen, and you're right, which we're probably a bit over the top of it, but you look at the analytics from it and you're like, I mean, I don't know how this guy is going to translate to the NFL. Has your opinion of him from coming out of college changed at all? Where do you stand on Josh Allen and the Bills this year? And what their sort of ceiling and floor is probably because of him.
So I think so much of quarterback analysis, again, because of social media, because of the way everything is in the world and politics and everything's one or the other, right?
Yeah.
I think most of the quarterbacks in today's NFL all land in the middle. I mean, Josh Allen's the bottom half of the middle, but I think almost every quarterback lands in the middle, and those middle tier of quarterbacks, like quarterbacks 8 through 25, could all have good seasons. Right. I mean, this is it, but, and at the end of the season, if Josh Allen has a good one, your boy Pete's going, oh, look at this. Josh Allen, he's taking a big step forward in year three. When, like, the reality is he has Stephon Diggs and Cole Beasley and John Brown. He's got this incredible group of receivers. He's got a good group of running backs. He can run the ball a little bit. And I think the Bills are set up for at least statistical success for Josh Allen, even if he doesn't take a step forward as a quarterback. So I think that's where I land. Like, he's graded poorly for us the last couple of years. That doesn't project well for him going forward. It's very similar to Trubisky the last couple of years. There's very similar vibes, like defense-centric team, buys into their quarterback and all that stuff. But I'd say the difference is Allen is now – his situation has continued to get better since he's entered the league. And you compare him to what Sam Darnold has had to deal with, what Josh Rosen has had to deal with, of course not even playing. But, like, it's just night and day. So I think Allen cannot even get that much better this year and improve a lot statistically because of the supporting cast. And I think that's the story for a lot of NFL quarterbacks, yes, because it's easier to pass these days. And it's, I always point to the Andy Dalton 2015 season where it was AJ Green, Marvin Jones, Mohamed Sanu, and awesome Tyler Eifert, right? And it's like, Andy Dalton's a very good
offensive line.
And a good offensive line and a quick release from Dalton. Like, you add that all up, you can have a good season. I think there are 15 to 20 quarterbacks in the NFL where, like, that's true. And Allen's, and here's the thing I always say about Allen. I think he has one of those years in him where it's like 58% completions and he has like 28 touchdowns through the air and another 8 on the ground. And it's actually not him playing all that well, but it's like, hey, at the end of the year, he accounted for a lot of touchdowns. He's an MVP candidate. Like, I don't know if it's this year, but I think Allen has that in him, even if he's not better, so to speak.
So that year you're talking about, I mean, so you're talking about like a 58, 59% completion, 4,500 yards, 35 touchdowns, maybe 18 interceptions or something like that.
Yeah.
AKA yeah. Blake Bortles 2015 season.
I mean, is that, there you go. I mean, but not all in garbage time, like Bortles right, in 2015, but not all in garbage time.
Well, and the thing about Allen is he's very vexing because I don't want to be wrong on him. And I'm not afraid to take a stand one way or the other. I just think that he does have a lot of talent. And like you're saying, you could see it all kind of click, but I don't know that he's going to magically mature into the third year into this unbelievable, unstoppable NFL passer. I think that's the problem. Like, the Bills can win 13 games because their defense is the best in football and Sean McDermott's a great coach and they added a ton of weapons and have built this offensive line around him. But I think you're right. You could take Allen out of that. So like, what is the, you know, it's war in baseball. Yeah. Yeah. Like, wins above replacement. Like, and you guys did a war stat because Sam and I talked about war, last year on the, so where does Josh Allen rank out in war?
I mean, it's essentially based off our grading and some level of volume. He was near the bottom last year.
Let me ask you this. Do the Bills win less games in 2020 if Mitchell Trubisky is their quarterback instead of Josh Allen?
I think I have a little more faith in Allen at this point right now, but it's close. I mean, if you look at the stuff and one of the things, analytics pod here, one of the things we look at, like, what stuff's stable, what stuff's unstable, like what stuff can you count on year to year? Josh Allen and Mitchell Trubisky, one of the most stable numbers for us is just in our play-by-play grading, it's negatively graded throws. Mm. And they're both among the highest in the NFL as far as negatives. The thing that fluctuates more is positives, and this is like intuitive football-wise. You get more positive grades if you have more open receivers beyond the sticks and you have a better supporting cast. So it actually makes sense intuitively that, like, the quarterback controls their negatives. Like, if you're inaccurate, you're going to be inaccurate. If you're going to miss throws, you're going to miss throws. But you can scheme up the positives, and that's where I think Allen can have a big year because there should be more opportunities because of the supporting cast.
Okay, now that's kind of, and that I think is important too, because football is so many moving parts,
right?
That factor into what a quarterback can do. Like, like Andy Dalton, talk about 2015, everything breaks right, and then 2016, everything breaks wrong. I mean, you know, like, your offensive, Whitworth's gone, you know, AJ Green's hurt, whatever it is. Like, these things happen, and it drastically impacts the quarterback, even though it's out of his hands. Are there any other stabilizing factors like negatively graded throws that you guys look at for quarterbacks or any other position, I guess?
Yeah, I'm creating a whole product for teams that, you know, teams have, they have our database, but I'm helping to surface like the most important stuff from a player evaluation standpoint. I think that's kind of a next frontier that teams could get better at. And it's from our grading standpoint, it's just throwing from a clean pocket. It's throwing, it's all the stuff that a quarterback does most. Clean pockets happen 60-65% of the time.
Like, if you talk from a clean pocket, you're toast, right? I mean,
Yeah. Like, because, you know, and scouts are always like, let me see this guy under pressure. And it's like, yes, those plays are good. And generally, the better quarterbacks make more plays under pressure. But the best quarterbacks, Brady, Breeze, Rodgers, man, they hit open receivers from a clean pocket. And they do it at a high level. So you start with that, and then you work to the other stuff. So it's all the things that quarterbacks do the most. It's actually first and second down being more stable than third down. You know, it's things that are counterintuitive to football, but it's just like, what do you see most of and how good is a guy at that thing?
Okay. I like it. I think that's important to know because it's easy to find that stuff. And for people, how high did you pitch at? What level?
Triple A. I sat in the major league bullpen twice in spring training.
Who were you with in major leagues?
Giants, Brewers, and Mariners.
Man. So wait, where did you play AAA then?
I was with the Giants in Fresno, and I was with the Mariners in Tacoma.
Oh, those are fun spots.
AAA. Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
About a year and a half.
They're contracting minor league baseball. Why are they doing that? Baseball.
So sad. I never would have had a shot. I was undrafted. I came out of independent ball. Like, I never would have had a shot.
Right. And they're all doing it for, like, greed. I mean, what are you doing? Like, they want college baseball to become like college football. Like, what, it's not happening, guys. Like, your union, like, jammed you in the 70s. It's over. Like, just pay for the minor leagues already. You're all rich.
There's six levels of minor league baseball. And honestly, so many prospects, like, need, not that they don't have to hit every six, but they need to at least hit three or four. And it really does get more difficult along the way. It's just such a unique sport compared to football, where, like, everybody goes from college right to the NFL. Like, you don't see that as much in baseball. Yeah. And I think, like, there's an ugly brand of baseball being played when too many young guys are out there.
Who, I don't know why I'm turning this into a, I was like, what are you doing?
I'm just multifaceted over here.
Well, who is the best minor league player that you ever played with?
Buster Posey, Madison Bumgarner. Yeah. Buster was my catcher in AAA.
And was he really?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
I always joke. I threw like 16 straight scoreless innings or something with Posey back there in AAA, and then they put me back up in right in the middle, and I gave up like five, and I'm like, it's just me and Buster had a good rapport.
When Posey got called up, you're like, you know, I should really go with
Posey. Right, like me and him, it's just, 16 straight scoreless, in case you didn't know. Who's ignore taller? My five ERA here in AAA.
Who's taller, you or Bumgarner?
Oh, definitely me. He's not that big.
He's not that tall? I thought he was that
like
tall.
He's like
6'5". He's from Hickory, North Carolina.
Yes. Yeah, yes. I was there for his first day of professional baseball. We were in instructional league in 2007. There was a rumor going around that he was like ready to go home. Like he was 10th overall pick, and he was like, how much money do I have to give back to just go back to Hickory? go back home.
I mean, he like lives on a farm. He lives on a cow farm in Hickory in the offseason, I think.
Oh, that's right. And then when he was like the fake, rodeo dude. I mean, not surprised.
Have you heard the Vin Scully story where Vin tells it, he's like, and then Madison ran into a rattlesnake in the desert and stabbed it with a cowboy boot. And
not surprised.
First and third, no matter, just right back into it.
Vin is the best. Vin's the best. I love it.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he really is.
He's a whole baseball podcast.
I know. Well, we do tangents on this podcast. This is just sort of how it works.
Perfect.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will tell you whether or not Sean McVay can fix the Rams offense next year.
The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The all-new Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third-row seating, available dual wireless charging pads ensure you can take on any adventure. Available H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on the dirt trails and kick up some mud. Standard third-row seating so your whole family can experience the thrill together. Available dual wireless charging pads so no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead phone. Whether you're tailgating out in the dirt lot, Carter Finley, shout out Carter Finley, or whether you're whitewater rafting, taking the entire family on an adventurous trip, maybe you're out camping at Mount Rogers. I used to go as a kid, wish my parents had a Hyundai Santa Fe. The Hyundai Santa Fe is perfect for your family outing. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So the Rams are probably getting a bad rap because they won nine games. It would have been in the playoffs with the new system. But people are sort of treating them like they're the worst team in the NFC West. I'm not sure where you fall on that, but I am curious what you think caused the offensive drop-off for Los Angeles last year. Was it Jared Goff taking a step back? Was it Todd Gurley being forced on the field? Or was it just a lack of offensive line? Or was it maybe something with the scheme?
It was the O-line. And I do think that the scheme has struggled to adjust. We saw that late in 2018, the Bears, the Patriots, the Lions, all these teams played a little more quarters. They played that 6-1 front and all these different things that just kind of thwarted the the Rams attack. I don't think they've adjusted that well. But all that said, like, the offensive line ranked 31st in our final rankings last year after being top 10. I mean, there were some bad offensive lines last year, and we ranked them lower than the Chargers, than the Bengals, than, like, wow, everybody but the Dolphins. And it just didn't make any sense. Andrew Whitworth is still good at left tackle, but, like, Rob Havenstein went from one of the better right tackles in the league to one of the worst. The entire interior was a mess. Like, it really started there. And, again, when I talk about the quarterbacks who just – you give them the ecosystem, you give them the supporting cast, they'll be fine. Like, Jared Goff epitomizes that, right? Like, all these
Kirk Cousins, three, too.
Cousins, like, epitomizes that.
Derek
Carr. Yeah. I think Carson Wentz and Dak Prescott still are in that boat. I mean, if you look at the last decade of NFL football, there's a pretty clear top 8 to 10 quarterbacks. You've got your top elites, and then, like, the tier twos, like Big Ben, and I think Russell Wilson until recently. I think Andrew Luck, Phillip Rivers. But, like, it's fair to say that Dak and Wentz and Goff and all these guys are in that next tier, you know, and just they need things to be good around them. And their careers have fluctuated based off what's happened. And I think that's where Goff is and where the Rams are. They do need to figure something out schematically, because I don't think McVay, not Todd McShay, I don't think McVay has adjusted quickly enough to things that are, like, right in front of his face, which is just you know, having some two high beaters and various things like that.
Well, and it felt like he tried to do this thing with the tight ends where he wanted to have more 12 personnel out there with Everett and how am I forgetting his name?
Higbee.
Yep. But then it also kind of hurt them because they were taking Cooper Kupp off the field and they didn't, and it didn't ultimately matter quite as much because the run game wasn't going and it was predicated on play action, and everybody had seen what the Patriots did in the Super Bowl, and sort of, I mean, it just felt like he got thwarted in 60 minutes. Bill Belichick just completely derailed that offense. And can he get it back? Or is it just as simple as the offensive line has to be better?
I think there's both. I mean, the offensive line has to get it back, and McVay needs to show that he can adjust a little bit more. The Belichick thing was fascinating because McVay was essentially like, I can't believe they played quarters. And it was like, I remember previewing the game thinking, like, this offense completely changed in week 14 when the Bears played like this, and then the Lions played like this, and the Lions have Matt Patricia.
Yep.
The Patriots have Bill Belichick. Like, obviously they're going to talk, right? I mean, I wasn't surprised by the Super Bowl gameplay.
He's going to watch the damn game. Like,
I mean, and Belichick is not shy of, you know, doing something different, right? And to be honest, the Patriots didn't even do it that well. The Rams just didn't have answers. Like, the Patriots don't play quarters, and they busted coverage twice, and Goff was too slow to get there, and it was partially Goff, and it's partially the scheme. All that said, like, McVay's got some work to do, I think, to adjust to that. Like, he's got this perfect offense that beats cover three, that beats cover one, that beats Seattle scheme and the Niners scheme and all that stuff. And I also think that they let teams dictate the action too much to them. Like, they had the Niners game down the stretch last year. I think it was the Saturday game. It was all bootlegs and screens. And I was like, they were so afraid of the Niners defensive line we have to move. We have to move the pocket. We got to run screens. And it was fine, but it's like, you're letting teams dictate the action instead of you dictating to them. And I think that's what needs to change.
And everybody on, like, you could even, like, half of Twitter was like, all they're doing is doing screens and bootlegs. That's the only answer they have. Like, Kyle Shanahan and Robert Saleh are going to figure that, like, they're not going to not adjust to it. You know, at some point you just sort of, you know, you flare.
It was just fascinating. It was fascinating to me.
Okay. That's.
It also shows, by the way, like, you go from genius to, like, oh, can't figure out the NFL. Again, in our Twitter world, it's like, well, let's not label everybody a genius overnight. I'm guilty as charged as well. Like,
the Cardinals hired Cliff Kingsbury and wrote friend of Sean McVay's. And I'm not suggesting that Cliff Kingsbury doesn't know what he's doing, but, like, that's how peak McVay stuff was. Like, I mean, you had to hire, it was sort of like the analytics thing we talk about, like, teams are like, it's like, go hire somebody who worked with Sean McVay. I don't care if it's like white, like, if he's like his get back guy, go get him. I mean,
you know, I talked to him out at dinner at the combine. I threw it on my resume too. Like, hey, talk to Sean, right? You know, talked to Sean at the combine. So
we had a guy named Bleep on our podcast. We're not saying Sean Wagner McGuff's name. Sorry, that's a bit. Okay. So, well, we mentioned the 49ers, and we talk about tight ends too. I'm curious what you think about, from a value perspective, how tight ends rate out, because we did these podcasts talking about Kittle's contract and Kelsey's contract, and sort of just the analysis of it, looking at it, it's like, man, like, you know, Kittle broke the market But I mean, he makes like Jarvis Landry money. Should elite tight ends, guys who can impact the game as blockers in the run game and as great receivers in the pass game, are these $20 million guys? I mean, are they being shorted in the market, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the numbers say specifically. My intuition though is if you have a Kittle or a Kelce or a Gronk, like, pay those dudes. Like, if they're making the same amount as Jarvis Landry, as you said, no knock on Jarvis Landry. Everybody likes to knock Jarvis, but
yeah, he's another guy we pick on for some reason.
Yeah, I guess it's fair. There are some games that he looks bad, and other games.
He was setting records for catches, and he wouldn't even
not going anywhere and everything.
Yeah. But no, but he was like, when he had like 125 catches and 895 yards.
It's right.
What's the point?
It was pretty hilarious. Yeah, scheme well, though, that's scheme too. I mean, I think the elite tight end makes a huge difference. I ranked all the NFL tight ends a few weeks ago, and it was painful. I mean, the Panthers, man, like some of the tight end duos that are being trotted out there in the NFL today are painful. Like the Patriots had four tight ends running like 5.4s last year. Like it's just ugly. And if you have that special one, it's an absolute game changer. I mean, when you throw to tight ends, it's more efficient. When you have a Kelce that can, he's a wide receiver that's a mismatch weapon. When you have a Kittle that's a mismatch weapon because of the run pass ability. I mean, I think those guys, the high end guys, are no brainers. I think overpaying like Austin Hooper might be a bit of a mistake. I think he's more of a scheme driven type of production guy, but I think the high end guys I'd pay him.
All right. So, hey, by the way, over the cap, get your stuff together. Update Kittle's numbers in your contract. What are you doing? I mean, what am I supposed to do this myself?
Where's Jason? Let me text Jason real quick.
No, don't.
He's got to get him on there.
Kelsey's numbers aren't even updated. What are we doing here? How am I supposed to do my lazy single click analysis of contractual deals if I don't have?
I need this too. Jason has a day job, unfortunately. So
what is he? I'm assuming he's like an accountant or something, right?
Something like that. Yeah.
I mean, it has to be with numbers. I mean, he's like a poet.
He's in the finance somewhere.
Yeah, I would assume. Or like a finance guy, right? You don't run this for fun if you're not. You don't run an NFL finance site for fun unless you're also in finance. So, but Landry's at 15.1 million. Thielen's at 16.2. Davante Adams underpaid at 14.5. Stephon Diggs 14.4. Allen Robinson 14. T.Y. Hilton 13. I mean, Brandon Cooks is 16.2. And then above him are Evans, Odell, Tyreek, A.J. Green, Thomas, Cooper, and Jones, like Julio. So, I mean, I'm not saying that George Kittle is as valuable as Julio Jones, but I think for the 49ers, and I think this is why they didn't flinch at paying him, like shattering the market for tight ends. He's one of the reasons that Kyle Shanahan can do what Kyle Shanahan does when you talk about building the story and execute. Yeah. You know, you have you can do a run to the left that then sets up a play action bootleg to the right where Kittle leaks out and all of a sudden he's just running like a freaking Buffalo in the open field, you know?
I agree. I mean, I look at offenses and it's just like, I think it's easier than ever to pass the ball, but you have to attack with three and four and five playmakers. I mean, I think you just get as many unique covers to people that are difficult to cover as possible, right? Whether it's a tight end or a slot receiver or a contested catch guy, whatever it might be. So if you have a guy that's a receiving weapon, no matter what it is, I think they're all of somewhat, you know, equal value in the range, and you just lock them up and make life difficult on defenses. That's how you do it.
Yeah, and I agree with you. The Raiders tried to do it this offseason, I guess. I mean, they wanted to add playmakers because they need some freaking some guys to catch for Derek Carr. And they went out, and I don't know if I have a beef with the Carr family. Like, I don't know if it's like a, like they know it's a beef or I really care about it, but I mean,
You warned me about the cars a couple of years. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah. I told you they'll block you.
I got blocked.
Are you blocked by all of them?
I think Darren run all the accounts? Is that what it is?
I think he does. He has to. He at the very least has like TweetDeck columns open with like search for Derek Carr.
And can I tell that story quickly? What happened?
Absolutely.
I mean, so one of my things I try to do at PFF, because people don't always understand everything we do, like how did this grade come about, whatever. Like I try to explain to people and say, here's why this guy graded well or graded poorly. Like here are the hidden things that you haven't seen. And Derek Carr is in the middle of like a 10-game, hasn't been intercepted streak. Right. And so I put three plays out there that were trying to show like, hey, everybody's talking about he hasn't thrown a pick and 300 passes. But like for us, he's had three like of our worst graded passes, minus twos, that all got dropped. Like I'm talking like right at a linebacker dropped, right at a safety dropped. during this streak. And it's like, who cares about the streak? Like, he's throwing the ball right to linebacker. He's getting lucky. So I just put the three passes out there, and I'm like, hey, this is what we do at PFF and all that stuff.
In fact, I DM'd you after you posted.
Yeah.
Like, guaranteed.
So watch out. Yeah. Then he SpongeBobbed me. He did SpongeBob text at me. Wait, about
what?
Like,
what do you mean? Like, like
the SpongeBob like, text. The upper lowercase nonsense. Yeah. So he SpongeBob texts me, and I get Raiders fans attacking me left and right. I'm like, this isn't even Derek Carr analysis. It's like, hey, we're smarter than you at PFF. Here's how we do things. And I'm trying to like,
this is interception analysis. It's not at Derek Carr.
It's not directly at him, but yeah, Darren comes in and Raiders fans attacked me. Before you know it, Derek Carr is blocking me and all this. It's like a Sunday morning. Like, obviously he's not on Twitter. Like, well, let me block this Palazzolo guy.
That's right. Yeah. It's like, you think Derek Carr. So I ran actually a Panthers blog back in like the early 2000s. And I'm wearing a Panthers shirt right now. I'm not a Panthers fan, but yeah, at the time, I really just don't care anymore. Like, whatever. If they're good, they're good. But at the time, I was a Panthers fan, and like single team blogs weren't even a thing. So I was like, I'm going to start a Panthers blog, and I'm a weirdo, but like David Carr had taken over for an injured Jake DeLome, who I think blew out his arm. Him blowing out his arm, but Jake DeLome gets hurt, and that's the season they tried out Vinny Testaverde and David Carr, and Carr shows up and he's wearing these little white gloves, these like little mittens. And so I dedicated the whole blog to David Carr. It was MrMittens.com and like a picture of him with like these little white gloves. I'm assuming he a bit like got around to seeing it at some point. And then just not for no particular reason whatsoever. Like, he was terrible. The team was awful.
Yeah.
For no reason whatsoever. Like, I also just, I'm not down with Derek Carr. I didn't like him coming out of the draft. And I feel like he's like a Cousins or, you know, whoever else. Like, you need everything around him to go right. And he doesn't take chances down the field. And his little preseason, so he's like, nobody believes in me. It's like, dude, like, you're getting paid $20 million a year. Like, John Gruden's not cutting you. It's like, somebody believes in you. So settle down. But Derek Carr, I know he did through that. He turfed that ball on the 4th and 15.
Yes.
Screenplay last year.
Right.
And I was like, ew, like, you know, you gotta give it a chance. And like Derek Carr, like, is tagging like CBS or David Carr's tagging, quote tweeting and tagging CBS Sports and be like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Like, he thinks it's a, you know, there's nobody open. It's a screen. I was like, I don't care. I don't care if every dude is lying down holding his hamstring. Like, it's fourth down.
Do something.
Like, dude, throw it in the air. I mean, do something. And that's sort of, I think that's where the beef is circulated. I'm blocked by them all. I guess this is a circuitous way of saying, do you believe that the Raiders will be good? And that, do you think the addition, like, I don't get the addition of Henry Ruggs unless they're just going to maximize him around the line of scrimmage and hope and let him take it deep. Maybe that works. They don't have a quarterback to stretch the field. So what does Ruggs do for you?
So, yeah, I'm all over the place with Carr. There was a point in 2015 and 16, he looked like the next top 10 quarterback. You know, throw this out there, the top 10, whatever that is, right? He looked like that next guy, and I thought him and Amari Cooper had this really good rapport, and that, you know, he could throw Carr can make every throw, and I know that's generic scout speak, but he literally can throw the ball down the field extremely well. Like, when Alex Smith was super conservative, you were like, do you really want Alex Smith throwing the ball down the field? And actually, he proved that he could do it too when he, you know, unleashed in 2017.
It's more mental than physical. It's not physical. It's a mental thing.
And here's the comparison I'll make with Carr, right? Matthew Stafford, before last season, was right in Carr's territory as far as like low average depth of target. Like, Derek Carr had the lowest average depth of target in the league last year. Stafford had been bottom five for a couple of years. Stafford has a cannon. Like, you want him unleashed. Last year, Stafford increased his average depth of target by 4 yards per attempt. Like, he went from 6.5 to like 10.5, which is absurd.
Yeah.
And he was incredible until he got hurt. Carr he's not Stafford's arm talent, but like, he has that in him. Like, if Carr just decided to be aggressive, and I guess my issue is like, you're down 26-3 against the Jets and you're still checking down. It's the situational awareness. It's that, you know, Brady gets, dink and dunk Brady, you know, people say that about him, but like, Brady, when he needs to throw the ball down the field, does it, and he knows how to adjust to the game situation, and he's good at it. Like, Peyton always, like, the best quarterbacks have that. Carr, and Sam Watson always makes this point for us on our podcast, like, Carr and Cousins, who you've already lumped them together. They're missing something from like an instincts point of view.
Yes.
And that leads to fourth down throwaways and Kirk Cousins taking a knee when he was supposed to spike it and he pressed the wrong button and Madden, right? Like those things seem to happen with those guys a little bit more. Carr had that terrible pick with no pressure where he just panicked and threw it up a couple of years ago against the Rams. Like, far too many of those.
But
like,
long awful too. It was awful. It makes you terrible out on a quarterback too when you do that. Like, it's like
wrong button Madden plays. I think right. We'll say that like Carr and Cousins, like they have those. But Carr has the ability to go down the field, and maybe having a Ruggs to stretch the field, it's just to kind of like induce him to do that a little bit more. I did think CD Lamb would have been the guy though. Like CD Lamb felt like the guy that he could go on the outside. They can work the back shoulder game. Carr has great touch.
Yak. He's a yak would have monster. Been, like, yeah. In the open field and he's taken off. I was surprised they didn't go with CeeDee Lamb there.
But on like, if all Carr does is just, like, stop checking down and just attack down the field, like, he's capable, and he's capable of putting it together a big year. My concern is the rest of the playmakers with the Raiders. Just having Ruggs doesn't completely change the mix over there. They're still, like, a bottom 8 to 10 group of playmakers, you know?
Do you think there's a chance that, like, Carr and – like, I could definitely see this being the case with Carr, and I don't want to belabor beating up on Carr. Like, we're going to get a bunch of reviews on Apple.
He's podcast. A tier three for me. He's a tier three quarterback, the same as Cam, I think, the same as Matthew Stafford, the same as a whole bunch of other guys.
Are you putting him dependent? I think Stafford's tier two. I think Stafford's tier two.
Tier two for me is high. I mean, okay. I just think it's like a high. So it's
tier
a high
one
bar.
Is like Mahomes and
right now for right now the way I did it was Mahomes? Just Mahomes and Wilson. But I think you know the last 10 years it's Brady, Breeze, Rodgers, and Peyton. You know, like, were the guys that were there. And I think tier two has been Rivers for the most part, Big Ben, Russell Wilson, Andrew Luck, Matt Ryan. I think all those guys have been in that group. And the next tier is
so you got Stafford like at the top of like tier three and
yeah. Yeah, okay. Stafford and Cam were close to the top of tier three, I think.
Okay. Right. Well, I wonder with Carr if it's like almost if I throw these picks, if I take these chances down the field, my picks and my interceptions are going to go up and I'll be criticized. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like him and Cousins think like we can't have interceptions. People, it's like nobody cares about their deep interceptions anymore. Like, I mean, maybe they do, but
in our world, coaches do. In our world, they don't, but coaches do. But like, if you're smart, it's like the risk reward. Like, this is how Baylor plays football or played football in college. It's like, I'm just going to chuck it deep four times. And if you go 1 for 4, like, you gained 40 yards. You know what I mean? Like, just be more aggressive and good things will happen over time, even if it looks ugly.
Right. Because if you gain 40 yards on 4 attempts,
that's good.
You're averaging 10 yards per play.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. So what else did I have? I missed. Oh, I know what it was. You also do a ton of draft. You do a ton of draft work, right?
Yeah. I've passed off some of it, but still.
Oh, and you know what? I'm terrible. I will record something. I forgot to promote you guys, you can get a discount at PFF. If you don't have PFF, what the hell are you doing? If you like football, is the code college? You get 25% off the draft.
We got CFB 25. Okay. We've unleashed our college grades for the first time ever.
Oh, cool. So,
all of our college grading, which has been under wraps for the last 6 years, is actually unleashed. You can have that.
Have you seen a big flood of people coming to check it out? I assume so.
Yeah, we have. I mean, it's obviously it's pandemic time, so I think all you know purchases football are down in general. But
yeah. I mean, all I think it'll be cranked back up there. We'll see what happens to college football.
Yeah. I think so. But it's exciting.
Yeah, people can get. I mean, check out Elite Edge, whatever level you PFF you want to do. I mean, you recommend it. You guys have the Green Line stuff where you can. What's better, the Green Line for college or the Green Line for the pros? It has to be college, right?
I think our college stuff because nobody has the database that we have for that. I think there's a lot of NFL people doing picks and all that stuff, and like we're in a good range there. But like college is kind of like the edge that we bring. Plus, there's quadruple the games usually.
If anybody says they have like an edge in the NFL, just in terms of like picking games against the spread, they're full of it. You know, like you just don't. I'm saying no matter what, it's just impossible to beat Vegas.
Of course.
A regular basis. But college, there's certainly some exploitable stuff. So what do you think will happen with, you have to leave this caveat. We're recording this on Wednesday, August 19th, the afternoon. College football can completely canceled by the time like, this is published on Thursday morning, but how do you think teams are going to focus their evaluation? Will they lean more on analytics? Because I mean, if the Big Ten doesn't play, you have film of Justin Fields, but it's old film and it's still him, but you know, you don't have as complete a picture. How do you think this pandemic will change what teams do for the draft?
Yeah, I think it is. I think they're going to focus more on the off-field stuff because you have like a smaller sample size, you know, and I like to listen. I know other people listen to like every post-draft press conference.
Yeah.
And I listen to some. It's interesting. But every single coach this year and GM was like, we got football guys. You got to have people that love football because, you know, we didn't get to see them and we didn't get to do this. So we got to get guys that love football. I think they're going to lean on this, like, on like the touchy feely stuff over the.
They might shy away from analytics and be like, hey, we just need.
Honestly, they might. If they were smart, I think they'd lean on us even more, but analytics are less powerful with smaller sample sizes. So you have a guy like Miami's 6'7" Gregory Rousseau, who should have had a breakout year this year. Like, he should be out there having a breakout season. Last year, by our numbers, he was good, not great. He was like the prime candidate to kind of like justify first round status, but he doesn't have that 600, 700, 800 snaps to like prove it. Right. But NFL teams are going to look at it and almost be like, well, he's got the tools. He was already pretty productive.
They're going to pretend that he had the 2020 that they thought he might.
That's what I think. But like, if you just went by the numbers, you'd say, okay, it doesn't look great, but he probably would have had a breakout year into 2020. Therefore, we're going to go by his tools. So I think it's going to be a combination of like tools guys with quote unquote high upside. And then just like the interview process. And if there's a Senior Bowl, like focusing on that, like focusing on a lot of the touchy feely and the interviews and football guys and all that kind of thing.
Okay. Last one, over under Tua Tagovailoa, 8.5 starts.
Ooh, I'll say over.
Okay.
I think they want to figure out what he is. It's fascinating though. The AFC East might be wide open and Fitz has played the best football of his career the last 2 years.
It's crazy, man.
He really has.
The bearded football zombie. It's nuts. And, right, you know what? I have one more question for you.
Yeah.
Cause I saw and follow at PFF on Twitter if you don't already do that. I mean, seriously,
what you're
doing. But Sam Monson has been doing these little like it's like, I think it's podcast clips that he's, then, you know, he's doing like a voiceover and say, you know, talking about it. But he's like, don't sleep on Dwayne Haskins. What do the grades say about Haskins relative to like Daniel Jones and Kyler Murray?
So we discussed this on the pod the other day. He's a little bit higher on Haskins than me.
Sure.
I would say his final grade was actually comparable to Daniel Jones, but it was like the construction of the grade was completely different. Now we talk about positives and negatives and all that stuff. Like Daniel Jones had a ton of positives. And he also had some of those high-end games where Giants fans were going nuts, right? Hey, he had 4 touchdowns and 5 touchdowns.
Yeah.
He had those great games, but he also had 10 fumbles. Like, he had twice as many. Like, he had – I actually don't know what his actual fumbles are because I go by, like, our numbers. He had 10 fumbles that we, like, really lowly downgraded, right?
Really?
And that was twice as many turnover-worthy plays as Dwayne Haskins even had, you know, the entire season when he played. So Haskins actually took care of the ball pretty well, but he had a high percentage of negatives. So I don't have a ton of faith in Haskins going forward, but he kind of played this conservative brand of football where he, like, his final grade ended up, you know, similar to like a Daniel Jones or a Kyler Murray, but it wasn't as value add heavy, if you will. So I still need to see a lot more from Haskins. He reminds me of Sam Bradford a little bit, like when everything's nice and pristine, like he throws good footballs, but I don't see him elevating everybody around him. And I don't think he'll have that chance yet. He's only got Terry McLaurin to throw to.
18 fumbles for Daniel Jones.
18 actual fumbles, and by our numbers, because you know how like you get a fumble for like dropping a snap or like a bad handoff, 10 of them by our numbers were like, that's horrendous. That's like Jamal Adams took one out of his hand.
That was a lunch, like you got beat up in the middle of the cafeteria type
right.
of fumble, right?
And the other thing we focus on a lot too is like the quarterback's role in pass protection and all that stuff. Like Jones held the ball way too long last year. Giants fans think their O-line was a disaster. They weren't great, but they were like middle of the pack-ish. You know, they weren't as bad as maybe it felt.
The Deshaun Watson factor.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And Deshaun Watson absolutely makes it. Yeah. Russell Wilson. The Seahawks have a bad line, but also Wilson does make it look worse.
And I would say, too, with Haskins, you know, we talk about what you put around a guy. And you point out, like, he doesn't have a lot of wide receivers. Bill Callahan was like, using a running clock.
Oh, my God.
He's like, I'm out of here after this year. Like, let's get this puppy moving. I mean, three-hour, 45-minute games.
They ran, like, 35 plays against the Niners. It was, like, something ridiculous, right?
In the rain. How can you know what you just can't know what you have. That's why I think it's crazy when people talk about Alex Smith or even, like, Kyle Allen. Like, they got to give Haskins 16 game. You got to find out what you have. And you
do. You definitely have to find out. And my concern with him, like, we had him as a first round quarterback, but in the sense of, like, you take shots in the first round because they could be good. But I had my concerns coming out of Ohio State because he was just elevated by incredible supporting cast. He was good, not great. And last year he was okay. So, like, there's still a lot to see, I think, from Haskins. But okay. Sam's a little bit higher on him than I am, I think.
All right. At PFF Steve, underscore.
We get the underscore in there. At PFF underscore Steve.
That's fine. You can follow him on Twitter. Great follow. Great podcast. Great website. Obviously, go read profootballfocus.com. There's a good story about you guys, like buying PFF.com too, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you probably can't tell it, but.
I saw it. No, I mean, we bought PFF.com. It was like a big.
But isn't it like cash at like cash and like back, like, because that's how these happen. Like if you get like so for instance, if the Redskins want to get like DC defenders or whatever they end up, the Washington football team, like Daniel Snyder's meeting somebody like under a bridge and in like by the beltway with like a bag, of, like a, you know, bag, a suitcase full of cash. Like, that's how
I don't know what the mechanics of that were, but I do know we paid for it and I do know we want to expand the brand a little bit. So being limited by Pro Football Focus versus just PFF.
Well, PFF is catchier.
Right. PFF is the thing. So you can't say Pro Football Focus anymore. We're just PFF. We renamed ourselves. It's PFF.com. It's all different.
Well, it's cool looking. All right. PFF, go there, buy it. You can check out, there's a cornucopia of information on there from player grades, everything. Steve, always a pleasure, buddy. Thanks for doing this. Talk to you soon, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.